Welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It's my pleasure to have Musonius Rufus back on the show. He is the host of the Rebel Yell podcast, which is carried on Identity Dixie. He returns to our show to discuss Reconstruction and the 14th Amendment from the Southern Nationalist perspective. Musonius, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me back on the show.
Well, thank you for coming back on the show. So, Reconstruction era was a period in American history that lasted roughly from 1865 to 1877, following the so-called American Civil War. It was an attempt to sort of reintegrate the, rebellious Southern states back into the Union, and also to sort of impose reforms, at least from the radical Republican perspective, at least what they thought needed to be done in the South. But there's much more to it than that, and I think you'd like to get into that.
Sure. Yeah. Among Southern nationalists, there's many people that support the American Revolution that created the United States, and then there are many that thought it was a mistake because of what happened later to the United States. But I'm in the former camp. I come by it honest as a libertarian. And what most Americans don't understand today is that it was a very different country before the Civil War, which is why the Civil War is so important and still important to this day. And, the founding fathers, of course, famously fought a war for independence. They seceded from the first British Empire. And due to that loss, the Brits went on to create a second British Empire that included Australia and all that, they seceded, and then they had a government called the Articles of Confederation. And then, around 1788, they created the United States Constitution to have, a more perfect union, so to speak. But it was understood that the states were sovereign nations that joined that union. And the states decided, in order to be part of this union, that they were going to cede a few of their sovereign rights to be part of it. But it was always part of the deal that they could leave, if they wanted to, and then they would get those rights back, like printing money, having treaties with foreign powers, that sort of thing. And but there was some ambiguity. There was always a group of people that wanted to use the federal government to enrich themselves, and there was always a group of people that wanted the federal government to be very weak. So Jefferson was in the camp where they wanted it to be very weak, and Hamilton famously basically wanted the British Empire with Republican trappings, a president for 20 years, that to act like a king, that sort of thing. And what they came up with was the U.S. Constitution. And the Jeffersonians were strict compact theory of the states, people, and how they interpreted the powers of the federal government. And then people like Joseph Story, Alexander Hamilton, Henry Clay of Kentucky, a lot of these people wanted a stronger federal government, especially when it comes to the tariff. Maybe I'm going too far afield here trying to set up everything, but the United States was a very different country. It was a compound republic. So it was a series of republics. There were theocracies in the United States, Massachusetts and Connecticut, because the First Amendment did not apply to the states. It was understood. The First Amendment was a limit upon the federal government. Connecticut got rid of its theocracy in 1818, Massachusetts 1830. But there was that time of diversity where, if Maryland wanted to be, a Roman Catholic state for English recusants, as it began, it could have been. Louisiana could have been, a French Roman Catholic theocracy if it wanted to, thrown an altar. The states were very strong and independent. And, the Civil War was a sectional conflict fighting over that federal government. The South wanted to leave because when Lincoln was inaugurated, he wanted a high tariff. The founding fathers, in their wisdom, created a revenue tariff in order to fund the federal government so that the size of the federal government would correspond to the size of foreign trade. And, so it was an indirect taxation. They hated direct taxation by the federal government. And some clever people figured out that they could raise this tariff to be really high to protect their goods because they manufacture goods and they don't want them competing against foreign goods. And so Lincoln, the industrialists, Henry Clay represented the hemp interest of Kentucky. He did not represent the cotton interest of the South. And a lot of these rascals, they wanted that high tariff. And there was a famous tariff of abominations, and South Carolina almost seceded. There were other issues like the Bank of the United States. South Carolina created a militia to enforce anti-banking laws against that bank and rescinded the protections of their state from the United States Bank. And so these were the issues that people were fighting over. The sections of the country that had a lot of whites, like in Wisconsin up north, they would tolerate blacks on the margins of their society. So when blacks ran there, they found the whole fugitive slave clause very distasteful when it was implemented. And so most of these states between, let's say, 1798 and 1861, whenever they had a real problem with enforcing federal law, they would become states' rights, and they would start quoting the principles of 98, the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions or resolves. Those were written by Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, respectively, under pseudonyms, and introduced into the Virginia and Kentucky legislatures. And that language was used to fight the federal government in all sorts of ways. And but after the Civil War, you have the era of federal supremacy, where it was thought that the federal government would have 51% of the sovereignty and the states would have 49%, whatever was left. And let's get into Reconstruction, shall we? After defeating the war, defeating the secesh, the Confederacy, the Confederates had all the best constitutional arguments. And so the Lincoln administration and the Johnson administration, they made appeals to preserving the Union geographically, without much care for its legal union, its legal basis. And they made appeals to poetry, such as the Declaration of Independence, all men are created equal, that sort of thing. But the overwhelming majority of people who fought the Civil War were white supremacists. And there was a lot of talk about what to do with the freedmen, the blacks that had been freed from slavery, as a war measure. The Emancipation Proclamation was a war measure. It didn't free anyone because it did not apply to territory controlled by the Union Army. But in 1865, now that the secesh had been defeated, they created the doctrine that the state governments had simply committed suicide. They ceased to exist. And in order for them to exist again, they needed to bend the knee and accept three new amendments to the U.S. Constitution, unilaterally passed by the winning side of the Civil War. The 14th Amendment is by far the worst. And the first paragraph of it basically says that you cannot deny rights to anyone born in the United States. Now, this did not apply to American Indians. They were considered foreign nationals. This did not apply to immigrants or any of that. The whole purpose was to keep the Southern states from disenfranchising freedmen Republican voters in the South. That was the first paragraph. It's one of the longest amendments. I think it is the longest amendment. So you could read the rest of the 14th Amendment. It's all about punishing the Confederacy. All those great men who fought for their states and for what they believed in, they weren't allowed to participate in in government unless they were specifically, they bent the knee and they were voted to be allowed to participate in the legislatures. I've been talking a lot, sir. Are you still there?
Oh yeah,
Yeah.
it's important background. Now, with the Reconstruction, obviously there are different visions of how to handle this, because yeah, as you mentioned, there's I guess you could say legal ambiguity created by the war between the states, because there was no provision to prevent secession, It was just presumed to be left to the states. I think as many as three states had asserted the right to leave the union in their ratification conventions. Of course, and those weren't opposed by any of the states, which means that it applied to all the states. I think it was New York, Virginia, and Rhode Island, if I have that correct, had specific claims.
Well, that sounds right. Rogue Island. They were always rascals. Yeah.
Yeah. And of course, all states exist in equanimity, so that would apply to all the states. And of course, it would be strongly implied in the, of course, the Ninth and Tenth Amendments to the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. And of course, the power to prevent secession was explicitly denied to the federal government. Of course, the government being only having those enumerated and prescribed powers. So that was a legal argument. And I think Texas, when it applied for enter the union, also entered the union under the terms that's still in their constitution, I think, the right to secede from the union.
Many states do have a right of revolution. The state of Tennessee, I mean, it's like number two, like clause number two, I think they got it from the New Hampshire one that was written, but it's the doctrine of arbitrary, the doctrine of non-resistance against arbitrary power and oppression is absurd, slavish, and destructive of the peace and happiness of mankind. So, you know, you're supposed to shoot back, you know, basically. Yeah. And yeah, government being for the common benefit, etc. That's the next clause that it usually comes after that one. It's the right of the people to dissolve the current government and form a new one for their peace and prosperity, something like that. These are the two right to revolution clauses that a lot of the state constitutions, people don't respect them now because they think we live in a federal supremacy with where the states are just provinces. But the state constitutions are a lot of times better than the federal constitution when it comes to fundamental rights and such.
And of course, a lot of people associate secession with, you know, with agitation in the South, because you mentioned the Tariff of Abominations in South Carolina in 1832 under the presidency of Andrew Jackson. But really the first grumblings or these calls for secession occurred in the North, you know, with the Hartford Convention. And this was largely in relation to Jefferson's embargo and also the Mr. Madison's War, the War of 1812. So it's funny that secession, the men who wrote the Principles of 98, Kentucky and Virginia resolutions, talking about, I guess, interposition and also secession as a ways to restrain or control the federal government, it was their presidencies that actually caused the first rumblings for secession in the North. It's one of those ironies of history. I guess whenever an advocate of limited government runs for president, he quickly abandons his principles, right?
Right. You know, Jefferson, you know, he's got a bust of Turgot, you know, the physiocrat, at Monticello as you walk in. And, you know, what does he do? He destroys free trade, you know, by doing to his country in peacetime and what our enemies could only dream of doing to us in war, embargoing our own nation, you know, with the, and, yeah, that's not very, Jeffersonian of him. And,
of course,
it's different when you're in the power seat, isn't it?
I think it was the New England states actually refused to even engage in the war against Great Britain in the War of 1812, because, they refused to, I think it was Massachusetts, to demobilize their state militia in support of the war.
Yeah, the that war is actually the most unpopular war in U.S. history, and people think, well, what about Vietnam and or Korea, the Forgotten War? It's like, no, the War of 1812 was pretty unpopular. New England wanted to keep, of course, it hated the embargo, and it didn't want to you know, go to war. You know, like you called it, Mr. Madison's War. That's a Virginian's war. You understand? Mm-hmm. It's not us. And they, Daniel Webster, who is usually a federal supremacist, you know, of the, you know, he's a bad guy, usually in my reading of U.S. history, but he waxed poetical and philosophical and moral when he was arguing against the right to conscript people for that damn war. Pardon my French.
Yeah.
And yeah, he's he turned into a states' rights guy then.
Yeah,
So.
and I'm sorry, the principles of 98 that involved interposition and nullification, right?
Exactly.
Yeah,
Like
yeah.
interposition is Madison's preferred word, and nullification is Jefferson, nullification. Interposition is technically it's where you come between the defendant and the federal agents trying to enforce what your state thinks is an unjust law. So you interpose between them to protect him, from someone who's essentially committing a crime under color of law. Yeah.
And of course,
And
yeah.
nullification is just, oh, I'm sorry. Go on, sir. I talked too much.
Yeah, nullification, of course, that's what was first invoked by South Carolina. And then, of course, implied nullification is if the federal government doesn't relent, secession is the logical remedy for this thing. Then, if that has to come to blows, of course, that depends on the reaction of the national government. But of course, nullification again implied that's a Southern thing. Of course, in the run-up to the Civil War, nullification was invoked by the no northern states, the free states, to refuse to take part in the fugitive slave laws.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. The states' rights has been made into some sort of boogeyman enemy. It's Nazis, Confederates, whatever. And it's like, no, the states' rights is, it tends to be for liberty. Not left or right, but for individual liberty is the way it was exercised. And, in American history, the states' rights is a great thing. Massachusetts, the New England, like you mentioned the Hartford Convention, they were the first ones to talk about seceding and forming their own union. I wish they'd done it, I
Yeah,
wish they'd done it. I think it would be a lovely place.
they decided not to, but they didn't say there wasn't a right to. They just pref decided not to because the Treaty of Ghent was signed, and they caught and the issue went away.
Right.
Of course, with Reconstruction, it has to the events of 1865. Of course, the assassination of Abraham Lincoln in April 14th, 1865, at Ford's Theater. He dies, and it kind of changes things because Lincoln at first. He had a policy of malice towards none, and let him up easy, his order to U.S. Grant. And he didn't really have an ambitious plan for the South other than just to keep him in the Union and have them keep paying the tariff and maintain the Union geographically, as you say. But then, with Lincoln's death, you have the accession of Andrew Johnson to the presidency, who's a Democrat, because Lincoln Johnson ticket was a unity ticket in 1864. To deny the Copperheads a victory in that election. But so you have Johnson, who's very unpopular with the Republicans, but he's also kind of a states' rights guy. He was a loyalist, but he's a states' rights guy who had some, I guess, feeling for the South, and he didn't have the share the sort of the extremism or the ambitions of the radical Republicans, the Sumners, the Stephens, these guys, the Stanton. These were real radicals, I guess you could say, as they were called. But this form, can you want to get in the politics of 1866 and led to this Reconstruction period? And
Oh yeah, the
then get into the what Reconstruction really was to the South and all the corruption that it entailed.
yeah, the yeah, the you got to first start off with Abraham Lincoln and the myth of Lincoln. A lot of people want to remake Lincoln into a 1960s Lincoln where he really cares about the poor, widowed black people, and but in his scheme. Which I think this was physically impossible, but he had dreams of sending them all to Liberia, to get them out of our society. So, this was not a war to liberate the black man and make him an equal citizen. What the radical Republicans did, and you mentioned that, so you see that there was a Republican congressional dictatorship for what is like 20 years or something after the Civil War, and the Democrats, represented the battle secesh, down in the South, and a lot of their leaders had been disenfranchised by the 14th Amendment, and so the plan was we're going to have blacks represent the South because the Black Belt is so demographically dense in the South, and they're all going to naturally vote Republican as they did until the 1930s, so we can really cut the Democrat vote, down there in the South by having freed blacks vote. What this meant in practice was that the men that had been ruling the South, They had a choice to make. They could either make a deal with the devil and then take it easy, ho hope that the blows are light, or they could go hardcore on their principles and then get tossed out of office, replaced illegally by the Union Army with whoever their enemies are in in that state, in the area. And like Tennessee totally chose the Machiavellian route. Tennessee avoided the Reconstruction, which is the military occupation of the South. It avoided it by ratifying the 14th Amendment. There were two pro-Confederates in the state assembly that refused to ratify it. So they went and kidnapped them and then wrapped them in rope and gagged them and held them in the assembly so they could have quorum. And then they voted on their behalf while they were gagged. That literally happened, but that was because Machiavellians up there in the Athens of the South, Nashville, wanted to avoid military occupation. Now, down in Texas, down in the Deep South, they were much more principled, and they suffered a lot more. The Union Army occupied them, set up a Freedmen's Bureau, and tried to start making blacks equal citizens, which was seen as threatening, and of course, not policing blacks. What happened between 1865 and 1870 is that you had about 4 million slaves that had become freedmen, around 1865, and a lot of them, ran off into the forest, or they formed camps, which were basically like hobo camps. There was a lot of criminality, and no one knew what to do with them. The Union tried to turn them into voters and such, but about 1 million of them were dead by the 1870 census. So it's an American megacide that no one talks about because of the myth of
That dying off doesn't get much. You hear the 50,000 number, which is bad enough, but there was a great dying off in those years that, you said no one really talks about.
No, because it's not politically correct. The Civil War that we have today is the 1960s version of the Civil War, where it's about civil rights, just like the 1960s. Originally, it's like a bunch of white supremacists and slaveholders fought on both sides of that war. It doesn't make much sense, that narrative. And when you talk to the victorious side, there's always appeals to saving the Union geographically. So, like President Grant, when asked by, was it Kaiser Wilhelm? Was it Kaiser Wilhelm? Or no, I'm sorry. I think it was Bismarck. He was asked, was the war about slavery? And he said, oh, of course, it didn't start over slavery. But when we saw that they were willing to tear our Union apart over slavery, we made sure to, get rid of it. I was like, well, that's not really about liberating anybody, is it? That's none of the men who fought that war. I mean, Sherman was he went on to go genocide Indians out west. I mean, he's not like a racial egalitarian man. And but the 1960s version is what rules. I guess because of the commies pushing. The commies love Lincoln.
That's
They pushed his imagery.
Eric Foner's view of Reconstruction,
The commies love Lincoln, and they do. They idolize him. They created the Abraham Lincoln
That's right,
Brigade to fight in Spain.
The now it's interesting because in 1866, you have the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1866, and then the 14th Amendment is there to sort of solidify it in the Constitution and also create enforcement mechanisms for
Yeah,
it.
thank you. Yeah, you just named it. I'm sorry. You got right to the point. They passed the Civil Rights Act to make blacks equal citizens, and they knew that the South, Southern states would have the power, to undermine and nullify that. So they wanted the federal government to be able to enforce it. So this is the first time in U.S. history where the federal government is getting involved between individuals and their local governments. And that was the purpose of the first paragraph of the 14th Amendment, the first short paragraph. And of course, that short paragraph has been used since then to invent birthright citizenship and the doctrine of incorporation, two of the greatest evils that have befallen the United States legally in the 20th century. The 15th and 16th, 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments are the Reconstruction Amendments. 13th Amendment is it's almost unobjectionable. It says you just can't have chattel slavery except for punishment of crimes. So slavery is still allowed by the federal government, for punishment. But you can't have chattel slavery generation to generation. So it's like, most people that love the Constitution, they're not that offended by the 13th. The doctrine of what American blacks were, what the Negro at the time, they were called Negroes. The doctrine was that they were their own foreign nation, like American Indians. That was basically the Dred Scott decision. That got around the biblical prohibitions too. In the Old Testament, you can only enslave a fellow Hebrew for what, 7 years, which is why all the whites were indentured servants for 7 years in the early, Republic. But you could enslave, foreign peoples, conquered peoples, indefinitely. It's a loophole. So everyone agreed that blacks were a foreign nation like Native Americans. Native Americans were not a U.S. citizens until the mid-1920s.
That's right, yeah. Now,
Yeah.
you have the
Yeah,
situation.
but
Go ahead.
yeah, go on, sir.
Well, you have a situation where, the 13th Amendment is passed and the Civil Rights Act of 1866 is passed, and you have the 14th Amendment, and that sort of overturns legally the Dred Scott decision, and also it does away with the three-fifths clause, which was there for apportionment. It wasn't a statement on humanity. On a black man's humanity is a statement on apportionment, and so now you have the situation where, yeah, if the states are reunited in the union under those terms, the South's going to have more political power, because no, now it's no longer three-fifths, it's 1-to-1, and so the radical Republicans institute all these restrictions on enfranchisement in the South, meaning restricting anyone who participated and so-called rebellion from voting. And so this is how they disenfranchised what 90% of the white population by enfranchising blacks, so they can create this, Republican empire in the South, right? Is that how at least that was the political calculation?
Yeah, and remember, everyone gets this wrong. They were three-fifths in the Constitution because the Yankees demanded that they were
Yeah, I know,
three-fifths.
yes.
The South wanted them to count as whole people. The slaveholders did. Of course, they would get more money from the federal government that way. And they came up with the compromise, because it's like, well, they need a little bit of money because those are feet wearing out roads and stuff, but they're not going to count as whole people. Anyway, yeah, you're exactly right. Reconstruction is in many ways more interesting than the Civil War. Everyone likes the battles of the Civil War, but Reconstruction is where there's this real fight over identity and over the nature of the Second United States Republic, if you want to call it that. Because everything was fundamentally changed by the Civil War. And so the federal government is getting involved. You see, the average person before the Civil War, they would only deal with the federal government if they went to the post office. I mean, it was hardly important in their lives. But the federal government, got involved, is getting involved, especially with blacks, and it's never stopped being involved with blacks. It's not like it ever decided that they were going to be regular white citizens and their state governments were enough to protect them. No, it's continuously used blacks as an excuse to get involved
Well, that's
in
even yeah, that's even
local and
implied with
state politics.
yeah, that's even that's an important part of civil rights legislation, laws, the special protected status, which arguably supersedes the Constitution, the new civil rights laws. But what you had in so you had that situation in the South. Of course, with this Reconstruction government, you have a lot of blacks actually being elected to state governments, and they're being used as proxies by carpetbaggers and scalawags in the South to rob the people blind. I think there was one state legislature spent more on cigars and wine than the entire state government spent in 1860. And you have the state, you have the South being plundered, and you also have organizations like the Union League, which go down there and plunder, and the Freedmen's Bureau, which is corrupt. And you have all this going on in the South. with the terror being used, these Union League, I think as many as 250,000 men from the North and also former slaves formed these large, I guess, armies or militias, if you will, and created a reign of terror in the South, which, of course, the reaction is the Ku Klux Klan, correct?
Yeah, there's many generations of Klan. The first generation of Klan is unobjectionable from my point of view. It was created by some, half a dozen Scotch-Irish kids in Pulaski, Tennessee. Everything was a joke, so Ku Klux comes from Ku Klux, the Greek word for circle, Klan because they're Scotch-Irish. And it's not serious like Freemasonry. It's a joke, like you put on donkey's ears and look in the mirror and all these crazy names. And of course, they're pretending to be ghosts. And it all started out as good fun. But when the occupation was going on and these terrible things were going on, it quickly became an excuse for night riding. Night riding doesn't have to be the Klan. There have been many night riding organizations, but it's where you go and settle scores after dark, because the government's not on your side. And it got out of control because it was too fun. It was a bit like the alt-right or something. The memes are too much fun. Anyone can do them, anyone can pretend to be you, So when they tried to make a national professional organization out of it, Bedford Forrest actually ended up officially disbanding that effort. And then the Ku Klux Klan Act of 1870 put an end to it, and it was revived on Stone Mountain in 1915.
Which is a very different organization, right? By 1915.
Right. That one was more American patriotism. It was really big in Indiana.
Yeah.
It was really big in the Midwest.
And if I get my geography right, is Indiana is not in the South, right?
Right. I mean, it's the most it's the most congenial to the South. It had a lot of Knights of the Golden Circle up there, believe it or not. But it's not the South. It's beyond the Ohio River, of course.
And of course, the movie Birth of a Nation, I think, probably stirred it on too. And there's always been a union between the Klan and also a Jewish interest as well, because that movie was financed by Jewish financiers. Edward G. Griffith's Birth of a Nation.
Yeah, I really don't understand. I mean, this was when the Klan was the most popular, and the second Klan between like 1915 and say 1935. But its reputation was destroyed by criminality, especially up in Indiana, like the big Klansman up there. I think he like assaulted a woman on a train or something and bit her all over her body, something very scandalous for the 1930s. And there was just a lot of petty criminality involved. But that Klan is so weird to me because, when the Cristeros were fighting in Mexico, the Knights of Columbus are supporting them, but then the Klan is supporting the darn Marxists in Mexico City.
Well, is that because maybe it's ties to Masonry?
Come on.
Could it be a ties to Masonry and anti-Catholicism in their belief? There's a lot of suspicion about Catholics. I'm just wondering if that had anything to do with it.
I think this is it's definitely suspicion about Catholics. I don't know if it has anything to do with Freemasonry per se. I think that's a separate issue. Mm-hmm. The Klan hated Roman Catholics because you had the big immigration phase,
yes.
And then in the 1920s, they closed the door on immigration, and there were all these Roman Catholics. Well, the Roman Catholics wanted to continue spiritual education for their children, and all these American Protestants acted like public school, was right there in the Bible. We got to force these people to become American. And so they really hated Catholic religious education. They thought it was un-American. We're going to force all these Roman Catholics to become good Americans and not worship the papist, emperor over there in Rome. And but to me, it's like, why didn't they see the problem of Marxism?
Yeah.
I mean, what was going on in Mexico was essentially Marxist revolution. Like, come on.
Yeah, you know? Marxist Masonic revolutions in Mexico and throughout Latin America, by the way, throughout the 19th century. Destroying the destruction of the Spanish Catholic Empire, but it's interesting because you had throughout Reconstruction, you had all these stories of corruption. There was one, I think, governor that pocketed $100,000. He was a carpetbagger governor. Men like James Blaine, we were talking about Catholicism, the author of the Blaine Amendment, he plundered a lot. And so I think Sherman, who went off to kill Indians, but he I think he had an affinity towards collecting watches. I think that was it. He made of stealing watches that he had plundered in the South. I think that was a story about Sherman. But you have this all this corruption. Of course, this occurs all the way up until 1877,
Right.
and there's a deal that
Right.
struck with the
What
election of
happened in 77
1876.
was, yeah, you got it. Yeah, you got it. That it was a corrupt deal. It's like, all right, we'll let you SOBs have it one more time with what, Rutherford B. Hayes. But Reconstruction's got to end. That'll be the deal. And so finally, the occupation ended by the Union Army, and the South got to be itself again, what was left of it. And but there were still discriminatory rail raids and stuff, so they really missed out on the greatest years in U.S. economic history, like the 1870s and stuff. They missed out on it. In a lot of ways, they were a sleepy backwater right up until the end of World War II, and that's why they still have a peculiar culture. Probably was that all those decades of being slightly discriminated against, but left alone. And yeah, you got it. The a lot of these, see, what P Americans need to understand, or what I'd like people to understand, is that as much as they may hate the planter class, oh, those aristocrats think they're better than than us, etc. The industrial class won the war, and so we're living in their timeline, right? So if you want to talk about corporate corruption, big business and big government being big gay lovers, that's it all started there. There was so much corporate corruption right after the Civil War. I mean, the Grant administration was notorious for it. That's when the word lobbyist was coined. The vultures standing around in hotel lobbies ready to attack. We're still living in that. Sherman, these men that won the war, I mean, their brothers, their first cousins, were all had their hand, in the pot and making money hand over fist. I mean, just like Lincoln did. Lincoln was corrupt. He tried to defraud a railroad with his old pal McClellan, and that's why McClellan, got to lead the Union Army and butcher a bunch of people. It was his corrupt business partner, man. These are businessmen. They are corrupt businessmen, and they run the United States of America now.
Yeah, they, you know, one
And we're
yeah.
still living under their United States.
One of the things they did in the South was they took off the sugar, they stole the sugar crop and the cotton crop, and then they tripled and quadrupled taxes, ran up the debt, which I think the South is paying off up until the middle of the 20th century. And and they raised bonds for railroads that are never built. These things, so you had all these corrupt bargains. You mentioned, railroad fraud, and of course the Grant administration, the Credit Mobile affair, which was a huge scandal, so you have that, and so this leads to a lot of bitterness. But it's interesting that, going back to the Reconstruction amendments, is that the states were considered within the Union when they passed the 13th Amendment, but they were considered outside the Union when they refused the 14th Amendment, when they at first they voted it down. It wasn't just southern states. I think New Jersey rejected it as well. In fact, they even, it was Stanton, I think, was a, or the governor of the, not Stock, Stockton. Senator Stockton was a New Jersey senator who was kicked out of the Senate because he'd voted against the 14th Amendment. And the 14th Amendment was never legally, it was declared ratified, but was never legally ratified, for what I understand.
No, Tennessee was supposed to be the one that made it legal, and of course that whole process I described to you of holding men in bondage in the state assembly made it illegal. So no, it was never legally ratified. But this was a time where people didn't really care about the law. They cared about winning, and they cared about revenge. So like what happened to Jefferson Davis was terrible. They just held him, and they're going to try him for something. But remember, all the best constitutional arguments were on the southern side, of course. So they didn't know who they were going to get to prosecute. One of the best attorneys in the nation said, "I'll take that for free. I'll defend him." And so they were scared. So they're like, "Well, let's just keep holding him." And so he was like a prisoner. And I think he almost became Roman Catholic if he didn't. He had a correspondence with the Pope. The Pope was, gave him and his wife a lot of encouragement, spiritual encouragement for his ordeal, you know. And I think, yeah. And but that, what about the law? Does anyone care about the law anymore? Not at that time, not when it came to the damn secesh. Let's just punish them. But this would come back and bite them in the butts. Let's finish up Reconstruction, or I need to go back to it. The impulse to resist all this, it was not really put down in American history. I mean, this is a whole black chapter that most people don't know about. But the movement generally was called the Redemption Movement, named after the kinsmen redeemers of the Old Testament. The great men that had suffered in the war were now disenfranchised. They weren't allowed to hold office. People were being embarrassed and made lower by this Union occupation and their Freedmen's Bureau. So what everyone was praying for was a redemption where they get to be in their own house again, and they get to rule it again. And there were fights. There were big fights. That statue in New Orleans that was taken down, what, in 2017, that was for a battle that occurred in Reconstruction, between the Redeemers and the Union occupation. A lot of Confederate generals that made their deal with the devil, it really hurt their reputation. Forrest made a lot of good talk about treating blacks as equal, and it sort of looked like, I mean, pardon the expression, I'm just it's a distant right expression, but it's sort of like cucking, you know. And then Longstreet was even worse. People who like Longstreet, to study his battles in the war, it's like, do you know what he did in Louisiana? He basically led troops against his own people, on behalf of the federal government. And so it really hurt his reputation with Southerners. He was
Well,
seen as a traitor.
it's only natural. I mean,
A lot, yeah,
I
go on.
mean, there's a lot of discussion, I think, in the 1860s by the radical Republicans. They were observing that the Southerners still had portraits of Lee and other Confederate, Jefferson Davis and other, renowned generals, Confederate generals, and they didn't have any portraits of Lincoln or Grant or Sherman. I was like, what do they expect? I mean, come on. I mean,
Right. We had a nice compromise going on in the United States. It's not my ideal because I'm a Southern nationalist. But the compromise was when Reconstruction was over, everyone knew that the Southerners would be good for fighting these imperial wars that the Second Republic wants to fight, like the Spanish-American War, that
Yes.
sort of thing. And, so there was a deal struck. After Reconstruction ended, every Southern state proceeded to make a state flag that represented the Confederacy in a veiled way. The St. Andrew's Cross was not associated with the South before the Civil War. But yet you have Florida and Alabama, they've got red St. Andrew's crosses. Georgia, it just had the Confederate battle flag and the state seal. And their flag now is just the First National of the Confederacy. Virginia's had always had its seal, but its seal sort of reminds you of the Lincoln assassination. Sic Semper Tyrannis, standing on the yeah. Tennessee turned the battle flag into a wedding band. Arkansas turned the battle flag into a diamond. Texas has got the Lone Star, famously, but the Lone Star comes from the Bonnie Blue flag of secession, which started before the Civil War, West Florida secession, that sort of thing. The single star of independence, with a on a blue field. North Carolina's also got a single star, a lone star. You go through it. South Carolina is about the exception. It uses an older imagery of the palmetto and the moon. But the Southerners were allowed to be proud of their Southern heritage, and we became the only nation in the world that would name our naval ships after defeated rebel commanders, and our bases, because that was part of the compromise. It was part of the deal. And this deal was violated in the 1950s and 60s by the civil rights movements somewhat, and it was completely destroyed in 2015 after the Charleston shooting, where it was decided that the South was weak enough that that all its symbols could be destroyed.
Yeah,
You know?
then you get all the iconoclasm the past, 5 years. Then it spreads out to other things like Catholic statues and monuments to Columbus, and even Mount Rushmore appears to be in their sights. And of course, Mount Rushmore sort of represents the schizophrenia of America, because
Yeah.
you have Lincoln and Roosevelt next to Washington and Jefferson. At least rhetorically, they all showed very different visions of America, Imperial America versus old Republic America. But the you get the you get the 14th Amendment and the Incorporation Doctrine, and you have with the 14th Amendment is there's different ways to interpret it, how it can be used. One thing is with the privileges, immunities, and these things. The federal government is seen as a protector of people's civil liberties and rights against the abuses of the state of the possible abuses of the state governments. And but the problem with that vision is I've read some libertarian defenses of the 14th Amendment, meaning that now federal judges can come in and protect people from abuses of the state governments. But the problem with that is it takes a sort of a it doesn't take into the issue of scale and oath. Also, anthropology in politics, meaning that best politics is usually local, all things being equal, of course, meaning that it isn't perfection, that you can have a nirvana fallacy, or you can create an idyllic vision of politics at a national level in your mind, and say we need a national government to protect us against the abuses of state government and root out corruption. Well, the problem with that is, who polices the federal government if it has a multiplicity of excuses? And to intervene into the affairs of the states, which are supposedly sovereign, then obviously those states aren't sovereign. But who checks the federal power at that point? Which what we're seeing today is that there's no check on federal power.
Yeah, I mean it's. Yeah, I mean, don't you just want to slap around libertarians that want to use the federal government to impose liberty from above? I mean, how stupid can you be? You know?
It's the ideal. It's meaning that if you have an empire, a global empire of liberty. It's like,
Yeah, well, I mean, it's so stupid because of the decision makers are fewer. Right, you have less control over them. You have a lot more control in over officials that are closer to you. And the founding fathers, if anything, hated monopoly. And you have just given a monopoly on everything to the federal government because in your stupidity, you know. I think a little bit of corruption here and there is a small price to pay, you know, for a lack of monopoly on enforcing civil rights.
Yeah, give me a. I take a Huey Long over an FDR any day, right?
Well, let's Gitlow versus New York. The doctrine of incorporation did not exist until 1925. Okay, so they passed the 14th Amendment when it was 1866, something like that, and it wasn't until 1925 that people discovered that the Supreme Court discovered that now they can get involved between individuals and their local institutions and governments. All right, so the first couple of generations didn't have the audacity to do that, but in 1925, in order to protect, you know, a communist Jew, they completely inverted federalism in the United States, but only the First Amendment. So you cannot hurt Gitlow's First Amendment rights to speak his mind. So saith the federal government, slapping down the state of New York. Okay. And then after that, they started incorporating amendment after amendment saying, okay, now we're going to determine what's reasonable search and seizure at your local level in Podunk, nowhere, Kentucky. We're going to determine what the search and seizure laws and rules are. We, federal government, we unelected demigods that rule over you. We're going, and then slowly by slowly, the Second Amendment was the last one to be incorporated. And you could barely say it was incorporated because it was Heller, what, versus New York. in 2008, I believe. So it took a long time before they thought that Second Amendment needs to be protected by the federal government. It took a long time indeed. But the First Amendment was number one.
Yeah, and you have
And so
yeah.
what the Supreme Court is. Yeah, go on, sir.
No, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, I'm just like, you see what they've done. It's like they went for it. It's like, hey, people are so stupid that they think that the U.S. Constitution is the only constitution in the United States. The federal government is the only government that matters in the United States. So now we're going to control the relationships between individuals and their wives and their churches and their schools. And we got a monopoly on it, you know,
Yeah,
and you know, the United States citizens are just dumb. They're
and
going to fall for it.
it's because of this. They apply the, of course, they incorporate the First Amendment. Then they have these very series of rulings in the mid 20th century that do away with obscenity laws because now pornography is free speech, and so that it weakens the local state officials' ability to police these things and enforce obscenity laws. But yeah, the best argument against the 14th Amendment is how it's been abused, particularly by the judiciary. I mean, the Congress has primarily
Yeah,
relied on
and
a very broad
go on, sir.
interpretation of the Commerce Clause and the General Welfare Clause. We have that, and the courts also backed it up with the Rickard B. Filburn and these things in the 1940s. But really, it's the 14th Amendment and the abuse of the 14th Amendment by the judiciary, judicial activism. Really, the backbone of judicial activism is the 14th Amendment, and this. Any number of examples of abuses of the 14th Amendment with judicial activism, Roe v. Wade, the recent Obergefell decision with same-sex union or gay marriage, and so, now, again, the best argument against the 14th Amendment is how it's been abused by the judiciary. You want to elaborate on that?
Oh yeah, well yeah, mentioning gay marriage, it's like, oh, now the federal government is in a marriage bed determining what is and is not marriage. Wow. How did it get that power? Did everyone get together and decide that it should have that power? No. Some unelected lawyers said, "I'm God, and that's the way it's going to be." Of course, the founders did not create that system. That system was imposed by lawyers, who simply took it.
It's equal
The
protection, right? So this is a cult of equality, which is selectively enforced. It's
right. The 14th Amendment was to prevent the states from preventing blacks from voting, black men from voting in 1866 under Reconstruction. But in 1925, they decided to use that same sentence, and they said, "Hey, if we combine this sentence from the 14th Amendment with the First Amendment, well, then we can protect a person's freedom of speech at the state level from their own state government." Right? That didn't exist before. That was just made up. And because the states have their own constitutions. As I said, there were two theocracies in the First Republic. Obviously the First Amendment had no limitation upon Massachusetts or Connecticut to have those theocracies. And the same thing goes for, the states were separate nations, and they're still separate nations in all the ways that are annoying. Like, you got 50 different criminal codes and civil codes and divorce laws, and dag nabbit, when it comes to insurance, the insurance pools, you can't cross state lines, because insurance companies want it that way. So states' rights exist when it's annoying. They don't exist when it protects you from
Oh,
anything.
that's a great example is the litigation regarding gay marriage or same-sex union marriage. I think for the purposes of declaring the Federal Defense of Marriage Act law unconstitutional, the Supreme Court ruled that it was a violation of states' rights. And for the purposes of imposing gay rights on the nation, they declared that states' laws preventing gay marriage were a violation of the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. So it's like, okay. The fix is in, obviously, right? And another example was, of course, the 14th Amendment was invoked. Equal protection justified the a lot of the busing policies of the 1970s and 80s, which no one really ended up liking. Students spent thousands of hours traveling across the county, so it could satisfy some judge's idea of what the racial balance of a public school should be. And I think there was one federal judge that in Missouri, under the guise of the 14th Amendment, arrogated the authority to impose taxes and also decide how money was being spent in public schools, going so far as even to pick out what type of carpet was being installed. And that's the 14th Amendment.
Yeah, that's the 14th Amendment doctrine of incorporation. And it was all invented out of that one sentence, which is funny because I told you the majority of the 14th Amendment's like about, Robert E. Lee. You know, it's about like, don't let those Confederates back in. You know, they need to say they're really sorry if they ever want to show their face around again. This is obviously has nothing to do with living under rule of law, the Constitution, or any of that. That you can go back to the Principles of 98 and see what the father of the Constitution and the father of the Declaration of Independence have to say about who interprets what is and is not constitutional. They said, since the states, formed the federal government as a compact, each one is an equal party to interpret what that compact means. Okay, so because you can't unilaterally interpret the contract that you're a party to, that goes back 1,000 years in Anglo-Saxon law. Okay, so all these states have a right to determine whether they think that the federal government, what it's doing, is constitutional or not. And then the rightful remedy is nullification, then interposition, and you work your way up to secession.
Yeah, and usually if you have the power of interposition, nullification, it doesn't get to the point of secession because people come to an agreement and back down, which is the lesson of the Tariff of Abomination crisis in 1832, is if the states have the ability, the wherewithal to resist federal ambition and power, it forces their hand to negotiate with you, and you come to an agreeable settlement, which they did in 1832. They lowered the tariff, and that calmed things down for a while until the, 1860.
With the moral tariff.
Yeah, the, right. Yeah, with the moral tariff. It's one of these things again. The 14th Amendment, what it's been used for, its abuses, and it's just amazing what they can think of. I mean, it's like, how is it? Do you really think the men who passed the 14th Amendment were thinking of same-sex unions?
And I remember, was it Bellamy? I think he was the cousin of the guy that created the Bellamy salute, the old Roman salute for the U.S. flag. But I think he was one of the few. I think he was a senator. I think he thought of it that way, that the federal government needs to now tell all these states what to do. And isn't that great? But most of the people who passed the 14th Amendment didn't think it did any such thing. And who cares? A bunch of unelected judges are going to say that it does.
Well, that's another thing is when you rely on judge. I've read a libertarian defense of it, and I said, in theory, I can see their point. But if you look at how a judge is selected, and if the government functions like a secret society, if you will, and networking and special interests, judges aren't going to be decided or selected for their, for their devotion to liberty and the Constitution and their scholarship. They're being decided for political reasons. Look at, do you think Ruth Bader Ginsburg was selected for her scholarship and her expertise in the law and her devotion to the Constitution? She was a feminist activist attorney. It'd be like putting Roberta Kaplan in the Supreme Court.
I have a little theory that as decision makers become fewer and fewer in a civilization, the policies become more idiosyncratic and crazy, because they better reflect what the individuals, the few that rule over everyone, what they feel, and not what everyone else feels, right? So I remember the Soviet Union had a space program, but not enough toilet paper to wipe everyone's rear end. Mm-hmm. I think they had HDTV or something they were putting up in the 80s. It's crazy. They're going to look back on this, the Third Republic, whatever you want to call it. They're going to look back on this era of United States history and say, man, those people were wackadoodle crazy.
Yeah, especially the judges. I mean, Anthony Kennedy talks about how he's friends with homosexuals. So therefore, he has to rule this way in the Obergefell decision, right? I mean, really?
Pardon me, but I just forgot. Was it Brennan who invented birthright citizenship in a footnote?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. A footnote. Okay. I mean, you have fundamentally changed our republic, and you did it in a footnote.
Well, the
And
same
then you
thing.
cited some sort of sociology book.
Wasn't the Santa Clara decision 1870s that created corporate personhood in a footnote?
Yeah. And that corporate personhood, that's a whole nother subject.
Well, that creates that, because then you create, I think, a shadow or parallel government, which we have today, how it's being used. And now we're faced with a situation where, sure, the First Amendment hasn't been repealed, but private corporations control public discourse because they control big tech.
Right. Well, I mean, I people forget that Americans loved republics and liberty between the founding and the Civil War, and so even the corporate charters that were issued by states, they sound like constitutions, man. There's all these rights and prohibitions on interlocking directorates. The past is more, it's a first world country. Corporate charters today, I mean, these people have carte blanche to create
They
dictatorships.
exist in perpetuity, whereas in the past there was always a limit because they were designed to create a specific objective, like building a road or a canal. And that's what was the traditional
Right,
understanding.
and they didn't see the difference between this is just a collective form of ownership. So all the usual rules of Republican votes and all that should apply to it. Nowadays, it's like we have a class of corporate officers that go like locusts, from board to board, sucking all the value out of what the shareholders own. It does not reflect a republic in any way, really. The shareholders' power is so little. But that's the way the plutocrats like it.
And you have
You
limited
know, but
liability.
Americans never think to apply the same principles, to this form of collective ownership as they do to their states
And
or their governments.
without any with their only their sole they have a fiduciary responsibility to the stockholders, at least in theory, so there's no responsibility to the community, whereas in the past the corporation had to have a purpose for the community. And with that coupled with limited liability, creates a corporate psychopathy. So you create in law a psychopathic entity or a person that has no collective, because it's collectively not responsible. So individuals within our organization will act like psychopaths. So that's what we've
Right.
created. Yeah. Now it's interesting. You talk about, we mentioned the sort of the libertarian idea of the 14th Amendment protecting everyone's liberty. Now everyone can appeal to the federal courts if the states are tramping on their rights and their privileges. And again, theory that works, but bring it up to today. I know we're coming up in an hour here, so I'll finish it up on this point. So what you think is we've seen today, with the sort of this manufactured COVID crisis and the lockdowns that are just being dragged out, the phased openings and the sort of economic, to me, it's a cover for economic warfare to destroy remains of the independent real economy for the triumph of finance capitalism over real capitalism, real businesses, and also create the conditions where they can impose sort of a technocratic control under the guise of a public health crisis. All these lockdowns and restrictions that the various state governments imposed in the name of COVID-19, theoretically, individuals should be able to appeal to the 14th Amendment, and the federal government should come in like the cavalry and liberate us from our tyrannical governors, but that hasn't happened yet. So the 14th Amendment proves to be a cipher, a meaningless law in the face of these tyrannical governors and mayors. Nothing's being done.
You'll find that states' rights exist when it hurts you. So like until the state of Oregon asks the federal government to help them, I guess Portland will just continue to riot. You're absolutely right. There is a plan, okay? Whether it's Soros or Bezos, and they all got together, sacrificed a goat and made this plan.
Interlocking
But
directorates.
The plan seems to be like they have to strangle and control what's left of the voluntary sector, which is the source of all real wealth. The traditional American middle class, and they are using they're fomenting revolution among the underclass so that the elites can achieve their dark political objectives. And these objectives, It wouldn't surprise me at all if they didn't already have Minneapolis, the burned out hulk of what used to be one of the most expensive cities in the world, if they didn't already have it planned out where the plutocrats are going to live in the middle when they rebuild it. And they could buy it for pennies on the dollar, rebuild it. I think the future is going to be plutocrats living in, their urban centers, and then all us, stupid chattel serfs are going to be working outside serving them. I think that's the plan. Don't call me crazy because it's going to happen.
Well,
You know.
it'll just happen out of circumstance, not because of any plan. And it's always the
Yeah.
excuse. Well, no one can plan these things out. I just did. You don't think they can? If they have the power to actually implement it,
Yeah, it's like when you're dealing with a skeptic, you could say, "Well, it's not an accident." Are you saying it's an accident? It's a confluence of interests that is perfectly predictable. We know that Bezos has been making money hand over fist, with this lockdown. Do you think Bezos is pro lockdown? Heck yeah, he is.
And that goes
And
for Gates, and it goes for all the other, billionaires.
yeah, the Gates. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation Trust, two different nonprofit entities, have practically monopolized research, medical research in the world. And using these two entities, I shudder to think what that's going to hold for us.
Or if you just
You know,
let it
that Bill
happen.
Gates determines, what is medical research and what
Yeah.
isn't.
To me, it's not even a secret. It's an open conspiracy at this point, as H.G. Wells called it. It's always kind of been an open conspiracy. They do what they do, and they'll have some cover story or have proxies fight their wars, and they'll call it something else. But it is a conspiracy of control, in which what you do if you want to control the world. It's like the World Economic Forum's plan for they've called it a Great Reset, and they've actually said that this is a great opportunity to implement the Great Reset. And something that ambitious isn't going to be carried out through normal political channels. It's going to be through psychological covert warfare, changing the material conditions on the ground so they can implement their programs that they couldn't otherwise get implemented if there were more normal economic and political circumstances. So they create the circumstances through the lockdown, through the control of the media. It's a very simple process if you have control of entertainment, the media, the news, politicians and these things. And this is the importance of that, of course, with centralized control. And apparently this network has been established long ago, for Agenda 21 and environmental reasons. These networks have been long established. And it's funny how much of the lockdown is achieving much of what Agenda 21 wanted. And I don't think that's a coincidence.
No, these aren't coincidences. The founders, if people like the founding fathers, they need to realize how much they hated monopoly. Say what you will, but the purpose of the militia is to prevent the federal government from having a monopoly army. The purpose of the grand jury is to prevent exactly what we're dealing with right now, which is corrupt prosecutors. No one came up with a system where one man decides that burning down setting fire to a church across from the White House just isn't a crime, and then there's nothing you can do about it. Okay, that system does not exist on paper. That system exists in the stupid little heads of Republicans. If these Republicans ever want to get their cojones back, they can go and talk to an institution called a grand jury, and the grand jury can decide whether or not that was arson. And who cares what the prosecutor thinks about it? Because the grand jury can even investigate the prosecutor and subpoena his butt. That's how powerful it is.
And the grand jury
So,
could
as
investigate
soon as
the,
these
yeah.
Republicans want to, yeah,
And the grand jury
go on.
could investigate the COVID conspiracy.
Yes, the grand juries are, they are to prevent a monopoly of prosecution. They are powerful institutions, militia, grand juries, trial juries, plea bargaining. The whole purpose of plea bargaining is to use blackmail to get around having to deal with the jury. That's the purpose of it. And prosecutors using it. Oh, there's that prosecutor again. We are dealing right now with corrupt prosecutors all across this country. That's why this revolution, this communist revolution, is allowed to go on. Because even if the executive branch wants to do something about it, the prosecutor says, nah, I don't care. I will arrest the person who defends himself against Antifa. I will not arrest Antifa or BLM who assault people or commit arson or kill people.
That's right.
And so, yeah, well, did the founding fathers create that system? Did anyone sit down and create this system? No. This system exists in the heads of our stupid, elites, like, or Republicans in Congress and stuff. Stop buying into it. We have grand juries for a reason.
Yeah,
Okay?
and you can appeal them at the state level. And a lot of these prosecutors are these are the down ballot candidates that Soros funded. And there should be a congressional investigation, something like the Reese Committee or the House Un-American Activities Committee hearings into these things. Because this is real subversion. This isn't the Russia thing. This is real subversion.
Yeah, there's a whole constellation of nonprofits which are becoming a parallel government. They could take an immigrant from the darkest part of Africa, move him 6,000 miles through South America, and then settle him in Maine in a specific neighborhood, in order to undermine the Republican vote there. And this is all done with not quote unquote nonprofit money. Oh my gosh, the SPLC is a nonprofit. It's an intelligence operation. It pretends to be journalists, but they don't hire journalists. They hire lawyers, because what they do is they subvert, blackmail, surveil, et cetera. And, but it's a nonprofit. So people get to write it off their taxes, paying money to this left wing, extreme left wing, intelligence operation. It's like having KGB, it's still around.
Yes,
It's here in the United States.
and the
Yeah.
ADL has like camera czars on the various, like Facebook and Google, YouTube, and they censor speech and content, and it's the same. Yeah, they're out there suppressing, and I believe they're also tax exempt, and this goes back to that investigation into the tax exempt foundations of the 1950s that the Reese Committee hearing investigated, and they came to the conclusion that these organizations were working for un-American and subversive activities. Back then, people understood what that meant, and but at the conclusion was, guess what? The Reese Committee was disbanded. So that was the sign of who was more powerful, the Congress or the powers that backed the foundations. Like, tells us that this government had been long since co-opted, going back in arguably the 1870s. When it was incorporated, the whole corporation, people make that point about the Constitution. I mean, here's a good example. I know you got to go soon, so I'll just get your view on this one. Is talk about the 14th Amendment and protecting our rights, relying on the Supreme Court, these learned elders of the law to defend our rights. Is yeah, they'll concoct a right to same-sex marriage with Obergefell under the idea, this screwy idea of equal protection. But when people in California are denied the right to attend church services under the guise of a pandemic, and churches are closed by the governor, that's not a violation of the First Amendment's free exercise clause.
Right. But I'm glad you brought that up because a leader sees opportunity in crisis. And what we need to do, if you're a Christian, is that you need to start practicing getting ready for the Soviet Union. Okay? There were churches, secret churches, spreading throughout the Warsaw Pact and the Soviet Union. And there are rules you got to learn. And I would recommend Richard Wurmbrand. That's the man that I listened to when it came to building underground churches in the Soviet bloc. This is a great opportunity to practice underground churches here in the United States to make Christians rebellious again, And I would highly recommend that. It's happened many times. For every single branch of Christendom, I mean, there are priest holes up in England, for hiding priests by recusant Catholics. Underground churches are big in China; they're very important in China, spreading the gospel, moving Bibles in secretly. This is if I lived in California, I would definitely have an underground church, and. Right now, the penalty will be what? You all get fined if you get caught. That's good practice for when it becomes you all go to the gulag. Okay. And I would say if I were a cleric or if I elder or whatever in such an underground church, I would propose that no one pays and we all stick together in solidarity. That we refuse to pay because we refuse to be ashamed of Jesus Christ. And that would be rebellion. And it would be a rebellion that you might just win in the short term, if it became national news. But this is what we need to practice. Even if you have regular churches you can go to, you probably need some sort of underground that you practice. And it's completely different, the underground church. You can't have fights, because people tend to mention names. So, you can't allow fighting. Yeah, listen to Richard Wurmbrand.
Interesting, yeah.
He was say again, sir.
No, so that's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Richard Wurmbrand was held for 14 years. Some old Romanian asked God, like, "Can I please convert a Jew? Because I'm a very I'm a very impatient man, Lord, and I want to see a miracle before I die." And he converted Richard Wurmbrand.
Wow.
And so Richard Wurmbrand was like a communist Jewish atheist, knew the atheist prayer and all the other atheist junk. And but he became a Christian, started spreading the churches. He got caught and was held for 14 years, 3 of which were in solitary confinement. And he went crazy. They told his wife that he was dead. Some secret policemen pretending to be former prisoners went to her and said, "Oh yeah, we had a funeral. He's dead." They held him under a different name so no one could figure out whether he was still alive. And he's fascinating. I recommend. I've heard a underground church lecture that he gave to some Afrikaners. I guess it was back in the 80s, and it's interesting if you want to hear it.
Yeah, I mean, that's something that Americans have to start thinking. First of all, the default position shouldn't be compliance. It needs to be dissidence and non-compliance, especially when the rules are so absurd as they are now. And this idea of thinking like a dissident, because just simply paying your taxes and following the rules isn't going to cut it anymore.
Yeah, but it's how Christianity began, in the catacombs, fish, secret symbol,
Yep.
all that. It's a veiled imagery with the shepherd and the lamb, paintings. Yeah,
So,
it's all secret. Yeah.
well, I said I had you for an hour and I'm cheating, so I'm gonna let you
Oh yeah. Well, I've enjoyed it. That's why I went over.
go. So, I want to thank you for
Well.
coming back on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And so people can follow your work at Identity Dixie and, of course, follow the Rebel Yell podcast, correct?
Right, identitydixie.com. The Rebel Yell podcast, we're only doing sporadically until St. Andrew's Day.
Oh, okay.
Then we'll be back in full swing.
Great. Okay. Well, thank you so much. I'll let you go. Enjoy your evening, and I'll post this soon. When I do, I'll send you the link.
All right, thank you, sir.
Good night, then. Thanks so much. Take care.
White. national.